everybody at the back, didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah,
but that's good. I'd just like to say thank you very much for coming out on this most miserable of all nights. And thank you very much to Paul for inviting me here. When Paul first invited me, he asked when did I want to come, what time of the year, and I thought this would be just the perfect time. Wouldn't it make the winter very short if I could take a little trip down to Cork? So here we are. This poem, the first poem I'm going to read is called February, but it's very much this time of year, and it might as well be late January. This time of year, the gossip takes its own road. We dine on root vegetables and the marriages of others. The Turkish reserve a separate tent for matters not seen with their own eyes. Here, the white mouths of snowdrops open to speak of my father's funeral. You, who are so many miles from home, write to soothe me. I see love travel faster than light. My personal jury is still out on poetry reading. I have many mixed feelings about them. You know, if they go on too long, poets never know when to stop. We're not stand-up comics. What are we? What are we doing? But the real reason that I don't like poetry readings is because I'm much more of a one-to-one person. I really don't like this business of standing up and talking to 30 or 40 people. And it's all me. And I'd much rather know about you. This two-way street. So I just thought that I would lessen that by reading a kind of biographical poem that tells you a little bit more about me. It's called The Coach. And somehow tonight I have managed to select practically a full house of poems that begin with the word the in the title. I have got other poems that don't, but anyway, so they're all here tonight together. The Coach. Her mother's face said it was a brown and shabby thing, second hand and quite beneath them. Her father mumbled that there was something similar in his youth, lost with the years. Sisters admired it, but wouldn't try it on. Brothers borrowed it, left it out in the rain. Friends were never sure what to think, tried not to be seen with it in public. Lovers stowed it in the water of death. During quarrels, attacked it with their knives. But she danced in it with her children, let their tiny hands stroke the wondrous cloth. Time came when she wore it every day, slept in it, woke each morning fully clothed. Okay, the formalities are over, you don't have to clap. Unless you're really driven to clap and this up here, you have to. What am I interested in as a writer? One of the things that I'm very interested in are legends, myths and legends. And I'm beginning to think that there are no new stories, that all stories are very, very ancient. And if we don't think that, it's probably because we haven't been to enough countries where we've heard their myths and legends. And this poem is built on, partially built on a Welsh legend that I actually read in John Moriarty's work. I'm sure some of you will know the Kerry-based philosopher who sadly died last year, who wrote this wonderful thing. Anyway, he's talking about Quill, Prince of Diffid, and that's the worst Welsh you're going to hear in Cork tonight. But I'll repeat that, Quill, Prince of Diffid. And in the legend, I asked Paul earlier if he didn't have a podium, because I wanted to do all these things with my hands, and I couldn't do that if I was holding my poem. But I'll just have to do it one-handed. So Quill, Prince of Diffid, is riding through the woods hunting a deer, a stag. And as he is tracking down the stag and hunting it down, lo and behold, another prince comes who is also tracking and hunting the same stag. And so the two princes actually meet. And at this point, they start to talk, and the second prince is in difficulty. So Quill decides that he will journey into this prince's world for a year and a day, or swap places and live in each other's kingdoms for a year and a day. And Quill will slay the thing that is so troubling, the second prince. And then a year and a day later, all this has somehow been forgotten because they've all got so cozy in their different worlds. But they go out hunting, and they're both hunting the same stag, and lo and behold, they meet again. So, where does that bring us back to? I suppose that brings us back to the supermarket. because didn't I come across an old friend who's also a writer in the supermarket, in the legend of this moment. Even at the distance of an aisle, bottled water, soft drink, crisps and snacks, though doubt and distance hold our greeting, I know it's you. Even at the distance of an aisle with a split second arc of recognition, two princes chasing the one stag, one writer coming upon another. Only the play of your life intervenes. Small sun, clamor boisterous demand, your needle white stabs at shopping. I am too far away to salute you, too remote to stop this drama, escalating into a crescendo of domestic strife. I would put out my eyes, save you the pain of witness, but still glide toward your disaster, and when I'm close enough for your name on my lips, you dive into the depths of the family trolley, a vital scramble into grocery, your elbows knife me away. While in the legend of this moment, being quill, prince, and differed, I would grant you a year and a day in my own kingdom, and taking up your guide, to travel to your world to slay all that ails you. Doors to other worlds being closed, I'm left to pass on the ground. Within ice whispers, dig on, scrabble in your pit. That which your fingers break is what will kill you and make your story strong. Thank you. So when I was selecting the poems for tonight, kind of one jumped out after another. He kind of told the story in my mind anyway. And I suppose that because, you know, I've known an awful lot of young writers, trying to establish themselves. And you will see them going along, all is going well, they'll win a prize, and then suddenly they'll disappear. Something will happen in their life. Or maybe they'll reappear again 5, 6, 7, 8 years later. So I think there's a great kind of sense of fluidity and movement in all this, and that we can have absolutely terrible times where we don't write a thing for a year or 2 years or 10 years, but we can always come back to it if we're determined enough. So this poem is called The Lone Parent Does Not Write. So it goes back actually more to kind of my scene in the supermarket. Between a bad back and a dead weight Hoover, it's been a month or more. Let's not talk about the duvet cover, walking out of the bedroom in search of a good home. At the same time, reading botulism, a resistance experiment. Results are good. Besides, my kids have more brains than to get sick. If their mother stops this frantic whirl, tend a fevered brow, she'd keel over, squeeze them from the bed. This morning allows I find our rooms again. Hoover the top of rugs, at least. Nothing fancy, nothing extreme. This way, I'm left with an hour, a tiny, sacred hour, to climb the laundry mountain, to part the sea of toys, and walk through with the Egyptians at my back, to stand just for 1 hour here in the Holy Land. So I suppose that the earlier poem I wrote, The Coat, was all about my struggle to become a writer. And this is the last poem that I'm going to read in that kind of struggling vein. It's called The Only Medicine. What's left when the father of your children has thrown a basket at you hard, upturned the kitchen table, breaking all the china you possess, driven off into the night? His absence clothing the house and the children as they struggle with the buttons on pajamas, and your thoughts are of leaving. But you don't leave. You don't go anywhere. They love him, want the two of you to be together, and that seems more important than anything else. The air buzzes with returning Land Rovers, but still he does not come. And this has all happened because you are both under pressure. You hate that Land Rover. And can't bear the poverty nor the stress of the unpaid bills, how everything could fall apart about your ears. Even if you do own your own home and 4 acres, though the house has no bathroom and the land so badly fenced stop to eat and Mrs. Lawless when to save your mule and donkey at breakfast and on her lawn. The only medicine is words to write it all down. Today, how that desperate blue bottle lands so accurately between the eyes. To record the butterfly that flapped, trapped in the lampshade. The way you shared it with nature, as she shared it with you, as the grass would start growing between the floorboards. And the world is in chaos, and that father is a violent man, and tomorrow, your daughter is 2 years old. So, after all the struggle of trying to be a writer, there then came the struggle of being a writer. And I guess I'd done various different things from that time, and one of the things I was a literature officer in the South Tipperary Arts Centre, and I had two tasks, or I had many different tasks, but one of the things I did was to teach a lot of creative writing, and the other thing I would do is to help writers. And so people would often come with manuscripts that I would have to read and try to kind of guide them in some way. And there was one particular young man who was a bartender and a funeral director. He's an undertaker. That very often happens in like small rural communities around us. So he had written a whole book about the stories of his undertaking life. And he had made them quite funny. But in that way that's really very, very difficult to write humorously. It weren't actually that funny. And at that time I was teaching a lot of adult education and listening to lots of stories. And I suppose these two things kind of came together in this poem. It's called The Funeral Director's Wife. And I'm going to read it for Paul, who very kindly told me that I was a good listener. Often I have watched his hands about Paul. The closing of the mouth like the closing of a tin can, deep and wide. The jagged edge of memory prevents its moving over. He will conquer death, make of it a business. Dressed in ceremony, his chiseled face set more stone-like within years. He doesn't know I sit with them. The talk he whispers is the first kisses. The way a loved one's lips turn sour in argument. We share trinkets, baby hair, kept tied in ribbon. Flowers pressed between the leaves of faint pink letters from sisters gone over the Atlantic at 17. There is the telling of waiting alone for the dark night, and of the shaming teachers and fathers, and I hold them, hold their passing, while in the scrub's yard he reverses to her. They say the sign of a life with too much stress in it is that you no longer daydream. One of the reasons that I'm so fond of Richard is his great capacity to live in another reality. So you think that everything is quite normal around you, but actually he's just pretending to be somewhere else or something else is going on. You know, when he's done something and you ask him, have you done it? Absolutely not, wouldn't me. I mean, that is an Adam has got broken. No, couldn't have been me. Anyway, the idea of fantasy began to creep into my work, mostly because it was so real and alive in his living. So I'm nearly two of these sort of fantasy poems, and one is just pure fantasy, and then the other one blends fantasy with politics, because I think at a certain point a writer has a responsibility to be political. So let's just unwind, unstress, and daydream for a minute. The poem is called The Farm Stand. Such a crop of tomatoes, such plump flesh, so red. You walk them with pride to the store at the end of your lane. All summer you tended their plants, tied, tresses, nipped above, talking to them all the while of harvest. Never imagining such riches. Place them in a basket you wove from the hedgerow, hazel and willow and woodbine, beside tall jars of honey. Again, your hand will reach to turn its amber to the light, and you'll consider your bees, even the one that comes now drowsy with heat, the back of the roses you bunched in their bars. Remember the year you planted those roses, and you dug the soil, you were working on that pond, the one which made you all that money that paid for your yacht and the trip to Antigua, Tahiti, the Seychelles, which was it? You forget. That has been so many. The day is long, you are in no hurry. Sit for a while in the Abbey Wandack chair you've crafted. Reminisce. Rest your legs on your greenwood stool. Think back to the day you stumbled upon those ivy twisted canals, Harrison, the mile code. It was long ago and autumn. Now it's summer. You sigh for sheer pleasure. The neighbour's child has just washed your new car, the coupe, also owned by the Prince of Wales, also driven by James Bond, his latest film. It pulls a little to the left, but you will have your man look it over. Not now. Now your work is done. You have collected a dozen eggs from beneath your chickens. In the meadow, your children and grandchildren gather wild dogs. Familiar steps on the gravel behind you announce your wife. She bears loaves of fresh baked bread. Your wife, beautiful, sensual, her smile lights to rekindle thoughts of this morning. Your wife, the woman who stood by you all these years, the one who always listened, who gave good advice, who understood your sense of humour and your poetry. Your wife, the one you would have married, granted that other life. So I think at a certain point when you've finished kind of messing around with your life and managed to get on with just writing, that's when the political poems have a chance to emerge, because before that you're just really just concerned with the biographical work until you kind of settle into a life. Carver, Raymond Carver, who's one of my favourite poets, always talked about that. You can never write anything longer than a poem because the chair was always being pulled out from underneath him. So you have to have a kind of stable life before you can start to be political, and I suppose the political poems are only recently started to emerge. This poem is very new. It's called For Every Doctor in Mozambique. And I'll read it, and I suppose because it's new I'm slightly nervous about it. And it is a bit of a funny one, I mean it's a bit of an odd one, maybe it doesn't work, maybe it does, and I suppose it will be very good for me if anybody had an opinion about it, that they will feel that they'd like to give it to me afterwards, that would be just great. For every doctor in Mozambique, there are 33,000 people. For every doctor in Mozambique, there are 33,000 people. And never having been to that country, I like to imagine that awaiting them. Now every 100 miles or so, there must be a vast atrium, all bright light and fresh air, like the central gallery of the British Museum, but larger, with enough good chairs for the 33,000 to comfortably, patiently wait their turn. And because it has already been rather a long wait, some of those women have become adept at delivering children, have developed breathing techniques, and birthing postures that the pregnant mothers employ without fuss or drama, so all that disturbs the patients as they wait is the sound of newly born babies mewling prettily like kittens. And because there are so many under 5-year-olds suffering from wasting and stunting, the kind doctor provides a kitchen where all day women with strong arms ladle bowls of porridge and soft brown sugar. It must be said that of all those present, 20% are suffering from AIDS. But there is great camaraderie in the fact they are all in this together. Adults, teenagers, infant children. And though grandparents are looking on concerned that they are about to lose their favourite son or daughter, that it will fall to them to raise another 7 or 8 children on less than $1 a day. They take consolation from the nurses handing round lollipops and storybooks, and in the knowledge that if they or their grandchildren do succumb to malaria or tuberculosis or malnutrition, it will mean they can keep coming back to this beautiful room, to the cool air of the kitchen and the great dark ceiling. And though 68% of them do not have proper sanitation, they can at least use the doctor's lemon-scented washroom with their automatic hand dryers and luxury soap. Why, in those moments, no doubt, their thoughts turn to us over here, to our medicine men, with their 350 patients who come and go in estranged orbits, rarely meeting. While in Mozambique, smiling orderlies are folding out beds. They are picking fine linen sheets, pumping feather pillows. They know they have a long night ahead of them. The good doctor has plenty of people to see. So this is another somewhat political poem, I suppose. I don't know, do you have transition towns in Cork? Anybody know that? The transition town meeting? Started in detail, didn't it? Well, there was a transition town meeting in Carmel recently. Transition towns are all about preparing towns and communities for a life in the future without violence. And I went along to one of these meetings, and we were supposed to just kind of stand and introduce ourselves and talk to one another for a minute. And I remember saying something like, you know, my name is Grace, and all I think about is the future of the planet and global warming and respect to that. And the man went to me and said, well, that's so all I can see, isn't it? And it's true, that is pretty much all I think about. It's just a horrendous way to live. So this poem is sort of one way of dealing with that. Trying to put it into some kind of creative form. It's called For Sylvia, and I wrote it thinking of my good friend and neighbour Sylvia. Her name also means light, which I think is quite a hopeful thought. And there's a kind of line in this poem that I haven't fully worked through in my mind, which is this line that begins up here with Nero fiddling while Rome burns. And then it ends over here with the men on the Titanic who played the violins as the boat went down. And I think we are all somewhere on that line. So, anyway, that's the kind of art over this. While the carbon rose, she was thinking of the street that a boy she loved had lived behind a low black street, with metal on her fingers, her innocence and pain. The thermometer risen while she was dreaming of a new dress and the shoes to go with it, the way she'd wear her hair, a man's hand lacing pearls at her neck. Islands began to drown as she was deciding what to eat that night. Something simple, one of those meals you can pull together from eggs, brown flour, a heel of cheese. For some time, she suspected things weren't right. She changed her life. Pleased herself to the land, planted trees, raised a garden. She bought a hive of bees, started to collect rare breeds, two of every animal. All winter, she fed the wild birds. She blamed herself for fiddling while Rome burned, knew her every movement came too late, all her small efforts couldn't change a thing. She tried on the whole wardrobe with despair, a hair shirt of helplessness, scratching pullovers of depression, the patchwork skirt of giving in. But she kept on, scattering corn amongst her flocks, keeping watch over her seedlings, putting seeds into the ground. When news came, panic in the streets, the chaos of people swarming to lifeboats, voices shouting, women and children first, neighbours gathered to her hearth. A man whispered, it was like the Titanic going down. The sound of her clear voice striking up the tune. one short one and then I'll read a final poem. Where Johnny Curtis, whenever he does a reading, has a lovely tradition of always finishing with a brand new poem. So I'll just read this one. I haven't actually decided on its title yet. There are horses in the water. Pebbles rumble their insistent mantra, and the mares wait for the monstrous storm that breaks the sea, appetites tapping their spines till they swell forward, an anthology of desire. Anyway, I still think that Rufus was better than mine.
No, no.
And they were the worst 5 words I have ever had to put into a poem. Okay. So once again, I'd really like to thank Paul. We had a great time. It's been very, very nice to hear from Paul. Thank you, Jane. And I'm very eager to hear your poetry now. So I hope you're all going to read, even the people who didn't just said they weren't going to read too well. His last poem is called The Work. I wrote it with a Kenny poet, Kerry Hardy, in mind. Kerry's quite an amazing woman. All day replaying the winter stream, mud as dark as the faint black wood which fouls its path, the stench leaving an imprint beneath my skin. Always this need to bring water to its clearing, to freeze and withhold things. Echoes of my mother and father meshed in the root tangle of crest and water weeds. Because patterns repeat themselves, and I keep thinking of you, Kerry, over and again, attending to the metal of your being, polishing its essence, turning yourself to find again fingerprints to clear your way. Evening, settling its blue mist on the November field, led me to leave down mud and roots and tools at the door of the yellow-lit house, knowing there will always be this work, detached things, always that which flows seeking containment, boundaries, and snaring itself in the flounder of longing and mistake-making. And it is the nature of elements that shine to also tarnish, in the same way that the expansive moon, which once more silvers running water, will in time diminish. Yet I also know you will leave here brighter than you came. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was good. So one more.